Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth lecture in the Anatomy of the Fed class. This is the 2012 edition of the class. Today is July 16, 2012, and today we're going to be talking about the origins of the Federal Reserve. So here's the outline of tonight's class. Now, with this class, with this particular lecture, I'm going to be filling in the details because I think we assigned Rothbard's essay on the origins of the Federal Reserve appropriately enough for this particular lecture. So I'm going to assume either you already read it or you will read it. And I'm not going to be giving you a book report. I'm not going to summarize and say, you know, first in 1896 this happened, and then in 1907 this happened, and then just because you guys can read, all right? And I think I can do more for you by giving you things that you wouldn't get from just doing the reading. But all that to say, this what I'm going to tell you tonight is not a substitute for the reading. All right, so in terms of getting the chronology right and the dates and everything and the various political factions and who was behind it, you do need to read the assigned material. And just to force you to do that, if you're taking the course for credit, the Q&A, the multiple choice quiz for this week, is not going to be something you could do well on if all you do is listen to this lecture. So I will have really easy questions if you've read Rothbard's, you know, the assigned reading. But if you didn't read it, you're not going to be able to do well on the quiz. So that's just to sort of force you to actually do the reading. Okay, so first, economic theory versus legislative history. And so what I mean, of course, is that when we talk about the Fed, there's two main approaches that you'll see for people who are opponents of the Fed. So you'll get a more academic type treatment that goes through what we now call Austrian business cycle theory, or that even from a libertarian point of view even, but does it very, I don't know, antiseptically or just very neutrally, calmly, and hey, there's this institution and what does it do? It regulates the banking sector, but hey, that's inefficient for these reasons, boom, boom, boom. And so for these reasons, it may be better for the general welfare, or it might promote efficiency, it might make society wealthier, avoid boom bust cycles, what have you, if we got rid of the central bank. Then there's a different strain, though, that talks about the actual historical process of creating the Fed, and it looks at what the Fed does in practice, and with particular emphasis on the fact that in practice, the Fed was not founded by disinterested academics who were just trying to smooth out the business cycle. It was not a bunch of PhDs from various universities who on their own, with no prodding from anybody else, just said, you know, my study of economic theory and the experience of the U.S. during these last few business cycles has led me to recommend the formation of a central bank. And then a bunch of Congress people were like, oh, well, gee, if there's these academics thing, it's probably a good idea. Let's study it. Okay, yeah, all I'm here to do is help my constituents have a better life. And so let's go ahead and do that. And, you know, that's not what happened historically. And that's pretty well documented. It's not just conspiracy theorists or something. It's well documented that the origins of the Federal Reserve were from banking interests. And then when you go and look at what the Fed has done in practice, for example, the bailouts of big Wall Street firms and what have you, I mean, you would also have to be very naive to look at the actual history and whom the Fed chooses to bail out and so forth, and think that if you disagree with the policies, that it's just because they made an honest mistake and their views of economic theory are different from yours. So there's those two different elements, and my personal view has changed in terms of what's better for evangelism. All right, so if you agree, and presumably most of you do since that's why you're taking this class, if you agree with the standard Austro-libertarian position that the Federal Reserve or central banks in general are immoral institutions in the sense that they're based on coercion and they outlaw private contracts and things that would be mutually beneficial and voluntary, and that they also promote the business cycle. The question is, how do you get that message out to the public? And I confess, when I was younger and I first read Rothbard's The Case Against the Fed, I was kind of disappointed. I was expecting him to give a self-contained treatise on Austrian business cycle theory and how the Federal Reserve exacerbates business cycles. And it was going to be a very academic, dry, neutral, you know, not ruffling any feather kind of thing. And that's not what it was. Rothbard spent a lot of time talking about the actual people involved in the history of how the Fed was formed. And I thought at the time, I can't remember how old I was probably in grad school or college. And I remember at the time reading that and thinking, oh, this is too polemical. You know, this is or ad hominem or something, you know. I thought that, come on, this isn't going to convince, because they're going to say, well, yeah, maybe these particular people were bad or their motives were bad, but that's not the issue. The issue is, you know, is the institution itself a good thing or a bad thing? And so what if it happened to be founded by jerks? And it's like if let's say you love basketball, if you found out that some, I don't know, Ku Klux Klan guy founded basketball, and originally he made the sport, you know, I just did that example. I was going to say to secure the dominance of the white race. That's probably, anyway, I walked into that one. Point is, you wouldn't necessarily give up your love of the game based on the founding member's personal views or motivations, or if you like whatever, race car, racing events. You know, it wouldn't really matter so much. You could say, well, okay, that's a shame, but who cares? And so that's kind of what I thought about this. But then the more I've seen these things and looked at political arguments or whatever, the more I think the average person does tend to get pulled in by that sort of narrative. And when people read the actual history of how the Fed was founded, for some reason for a lot of people, that resonates with them because they can smell a rat. And the same thing with Bernanke and the stuff he was doing. I tell, you know, if I'm going to go give a lecture somewhere talking about the dangers of having an overly powerful central bank, I mean, I can put up charts of monetary base and stuff like that, and I can talk about, oh, the interest rate coordinates. And that, you know, you got to do that stuff. You have to have the academic stuff there, the infrastructure. But when you say Bernanke's handing out billions of dollars behind the scenes and Congress calls in front of them in December of 2008 and says, we're not second-guessing what you're doing. We just want you to tell us who you're giving all these billions of dollars to. And Bernanke says, no, I'm not going to tell you because that would defeat the purpose of the program. And so he doesn't even tell Congress. He's creating billions of dollars out of thin air and handing them out to rich people and doesn't even tell Congress who he's giving the money to. That makes people sit up, like normal Americans, because they know, whoa, something's fishy there. And you can get a lot of people to realize something crazy is going on with that sort of narrative, as opposed to just doing a real dry, you know, what would a free market in banking look like? What do we have with, you know, because you have to be a trained economist to really interpret that. But you don't have to be a trained economist to know someone handed out billions of dollars and then not even telling Congress, even though his agency was set up by the federal government and everything, and that's where it gets its statutory powers from, not even telling who he's giving money to. Everyone knows that's fishy. So anyway, my point is just in case you're wondering why Rothbard takes the approach he does and why he spends so much of his time on the history when you might be thinking that's a waste of time. Like, who cares? That's irrelevant. The thing is, the fact is we got the central bank here. The point is it a good or a bad thing? And if it's bad, we got to convince Americans why it's bad. My point is that those aren't separate tasks. That for a lot of people who are not trained economists and don't already believe in the non-aggression axiom and Austrian business cycle theory and all that kind of stuff, they aren't stupid. And they can understand, wait a minute, if a bunch of rich Wall Street guys and international bankers and a couple of corrupt senators got on a train and went with assumed names to some secret location somewhere and plotted something out, that's fishy. The thing that came out of that sort of environment is not probably, does not have my best interest at heart. Okay, so the irony, and here I know we have a lot of international students, so that's why I'm going to not assume everybody knows this stuff. The irony is that in the United States, there's this thing called the Progressive Movement that was typically dated from the 1890s to the 1920s. And it is now, so Paul Krugman, he has on his blog Conscience of a Liberal, right? So in the American vernacular now, liberal means the opposite, the two ends of the spectrum are liberal and conservative, and that's a very silly way to classify political thought, because both people calling themselves that are really all interventionists, and they just have little differences of degree and emphasis. And certainly liberal in that sense is not at all what we mean by a classical liberal, like the sense in which Mises and Hayek could be called liberals is not at all what Paul Krugman means when he says on his blog, Conscience of a Liberal. And what's interesting, though, is that word has become a smear. Right? So people who are liberal in the Paul Krugman sense, a lot of them don't even want to call themselves liberal now because they have so much baggage with it. And so now the term they started using more and more, I started really noticing this shift about 5 years ago, is to call themselves progressives. And so that harkens back to the Progressive Movement. And they're interventionists, okay? But in their view, they were doing things, and so, like, you know, their hero is Teddy Roosevelt, the so-called Trust Buster. And they, you know, they have all sorts of, well, I can get on the next slide, but before I move on, let me just note the irony again. You would think, who would be the icon for people who care about the downtrodden and who want to protect the little guy from big, powerful, evil forces out there? You wouldn't think it would be a guy who was real violent and, like, you know, had led force troops against defenseless people and was kind of a chain killer. And yet that's who their icon is. And so that kind of is typical with this sort of thing that, you know, other examples, Woodrow Wilson and FDR are like the revered saints, and Abraham Lincoln too, of people who believe in the power of government to help people. And yet they also were at a helm when U.S. forces killed lots and lots of civilians. And so you just, that's something that for some reason I didn't notice until later, and you just want to point that out. Okay, so official story, what I mean by this is, if you ask a progressive, a self-identified progressive, what he or she stands for, or if you take a typical American history course, or like Americans when they're going through, I don't know, fifth grade or sixth grade or something, and they learn about U.S. history from this era, these are the kinds of things you're going to be taught. You're going to be taught that, that, you know, this is big business, just eating children alive and stuff. You know, kids worked in factories under laissez-faire capitalism in the 1800s. It was just brutal. Well, you know, that's when we actually had an unregulated market where the profit motive ruled everything. And they'd say, oh, you had really disgusting stuff like hamburger meat would have all the rodents in it and stuff. And, of course, that was all popularized by this book, The Jungle, by Upton Sinclair. And if you've never read that, I mean, it follows the protagonist is an immigrant, and and he buys a house, and he even has a lawyer, like, check out the contract and everything, and he goes, oh, yeah, it's legitimate. And then he misses one payment, and the bank comes and takes his house away or something. You know, he was so close to paying it off. And he works at a meatpacking plant, and there's just all sorts of disgusting stuff that in the novel happens, like, all, you know, people sweeping rat droppings and stuff right into the meat instead of putting it separately in the garbage, and then guys get their hands mangled in the machinery, and they just let that go out, you know, like, so some guy's finger goes into the thing, and they just go and package that and sell it to some American somewhere, think he's eating hamburger, and he's eating some guy's finger, that kind of stuff. It's a real disgusting thing, and that was a big part of the impetus for the creation of the Food and Drug Administration. And so now, you know, so the federal bureaucracy that has the power to regulate the purity of food and drugs came out of the progressive movement. So most Americans today would think, oh yeah, before we had, you know, in the savage days of 1905 or whatever, people could just sell whatever they wanted, and thank goodness the progressive movement gave us federal regulations on this stuff, so at least has some kind of rules in place to protect the consumer from just the most ruthless anti-consumer behavior on the part of businessmen. Because why? Because the businessmen, all they care about is money, and hey, why wouldn't you, you know, it's too expensive to have, if it's cheaper to just have machinery that has the gears out in the open, and yeah, once in a while a worker's going to get his hand chopped off, but hey, I'd rather that happen if I'm the owner than spend the money to have some sort of, you know, safety mechanism, like a guard, a plastic guard around the gears or something, then that's, or you might think, oh, why don't we have shorter shifts? Because maybe the reason workers get their hands mangled is because they kind of doze off because they're working 15-hour shifts, and they kind of doze off, and then their hand goes in the thing. Why don't we just have 8-hour shifts? Well, because that's not profitable, or just that's profitable, right? So that's the idea, and that I think a lot of people believe, if it weren't for federal intervention that came out of the progressive era, to this day, workers would be getting their hands chopped off every other day in the meatpacking plants, and you'd still be eating guys' fingers if it weren't for the government to come in and put up laws to stop that. And so that's the official storyline. Incidentally, as far as this book, The Jungle, the guy Upton Sinclair was a socialist, and he was trying to horrify Americans, and he's got some quote. I'm going to mangle the exact quote, but he was disappointed because he didn't want there to just be regulations put in place to regulate big business. He wanted Americans to realize what he thought of was that the profit motive is a bad way to motivate people. We need socialism. And so he said something like, with my book, I was trying to turn Americans' hearts or minds, and instead I turned their stomachs. Okay, meaning he wanted everyone to read that book and realize how awful capitalism was, and instead they read it and thought, ugh, the meatpacking industry is disgusting. We need to put in some regulations. And as it turns out, he just made all that stuff up. Right? I'm not saying I would, if I had the choice between eating bologna packaged last week or that was made in 1895 and could be time transported to today, which would I choose? I would choose the bologna that was made today. Okay, so I'm not saying I want to eat the meat that came out of Chicago plants back in the 1800s, but the point is the specific stories he made up, he just made up. And it's, you know, it's not like there were workers getting their hands chopped off and that was getting packaged and this was documented or something. And F.A. Hayek has a collection called, what is it called? Does anybody know off the top of their head? Capitalism and the Historians. And in there, I think he's got an essay. I can't remember if Hayek wrote it. I think Hayek did write it, but I could be wrong about that. If somebody else was the contributor. But they deal with this particular issue. And then there's other people who have debunked this. I think I'm pretty sure Larry Reed has a piece on this also, just about historically the stuff. You know, in other words, was the meatpacking industry before federal regulations, was it as disgusting as Americans are taught? And the answer is no, it wasn't. With all this stuff, you know, it's with child labor and work safety regulations, things like. Another example of progressive era legislation would be things like fire codes, stuff like that, that, you know, nowadays people are horrified. Like, you mean you used to be able to build a building that was a cinder box, and that if a fire broke out somewhere, then the whole thing would be engulfed in flames? Well, thank goodness now we have fire codes in place. But the government puts out strict regulations saying if you're going to build a building, you got to have sprinklers in place, you got to have fire extinguishers every such and such feet, you got to have a fire escape that's attached so that in case, you know, so people can get out. Because there was, you know, these horrible cases, the Triangle Waistcoat Factory, I think it was called, and hundreds of workers died in this inferno because the owners were greedy and they didn't have adequate ventilation in the place, and they didn't want to spring for the money to have a fire escape, right? Because that would cost money, and the workers are willing to come to work even if it's not fire escape. So why would I, on the employer, why would I spend more money to put up this metal thing on the side of the building on the off chance that a fire breaks out? That's crazy. So, you know, nowadays people hear about that and they're horrified. But again, it's an issue of cost and trade-offs, like everything is in economics. So, for example, when I went to Haiti, I went there after an earthquake. I went and did some relief efforts there. And I was talking to the engineers who were going around, and what they're just, so I was just like on the grunt work, you know, that's kind of what I wanted to do, is just to do, you know, standard. So I was going out with the sledgehammers and breaking rubble up and stuff and just moving debris off of these people's property so they could start from zero. I mean, they were so poor, it was like they had negative wealth because they had their land where their house used to be, and instead of it just being empty, there was a bunch of huge rocks sitting there that they couldn't move because they weren't strong enough. You know, they were big rocks and they didn't have equipment. So we were doing them a favor by coming with wheelbarrows and sledgehammers and breaking up the rocks and carting them away so they could start from nothing. And that was our contribution, and actually was a contribution. But anyway, the American engineers who were with my group, their job was to go around for people whose houses hadn't collapsed in the earthquake. They were all still living in the street, you know, sleeping in the out in the street because they were afraid their house was going to cave in. You know, they were afraid that the earthquake would have damaged the structural integrity and that the thing just waiting to collapse at any moment. They didn't want to be sleeping in the middle of the night and the roof comes down on them. So these engineers, their job was to go around and just look at the buildings and then tell the families, yeah, this one's actually safe for you to stay in, or yeah, don't stay in this, for the thing's going to collapse any day now. So I was talking to those guys and ladies, there were some women, and trying to get them to tell me that all these buildings in Haiti, because clearly the buildings were not built to code, like a U.S. code, you know what I'm saying? Like they would have all been illegal. But, and that's what many interventionists in the U.S. at the time were saying. They're saying, see, this is why you need strong government, because in Haiti, they didn't have building codes, and look what happened. There was a little, there were not a little, but there was an earthquake, and look at how many thousands of people died because they didn't have the building codes. Whereas in California, when there's an earthquake, it doesn't do nearly as much damage because the building, you know, we have strong government. So that, of course, is silly to say that Haiti doesn't have a strong government. I mean, they were run by dictators, basically, or, well, dictator is a strong word, but they certainly had a strong state. It wasn't like you're in Haiti and you didn't know there was a government or not. That was not the case. So I was asking these people, these engineers, what would have happened if they had, you know, U.S.-style codes? Would it, you know, could they have built these buildings or not? And they, unfortunately, the engineers really didn't get my question because I was trying to get them to answer me how much of, because the recommendations they were giving to the people in Haiti for how to rebuild, they were telling me, yeah, what we're telling them is not up to U.S. code. But it's just what they have to work with. If we told them the U.S. code, they wouldn't be able to do anything. Like, they don't have the equipment to do it right. You know, 10,000 houses get knocked down. If they try to do it the way we're telling them you should do it according to U.S. standards, maybe they could build 100 new houses, and that would be it. That would be all they could afford to do. So I was trying to get them to speak like that to me and to say, was it because they just they needed better knowledge, or was it just a lack of material resources as to what caused the catastrophe? And they, like I say, unfortunately, they quite didn't get the distinction I was making. They just kept repeating the same thing over and over to me. But I gathered out of it that it was a little of both. In other words, if all the engineers in Haiti had been trained in the U.S., the houses would have, for the same price, would have been built a little bit sturdier, but still, it would not have been like a bunch of buildings in California. They just could not have afforded to do that. So the same thing here, like the whole story of, okay, this factory that was making garments or something, and a fire breaks out and 200 people die because there wasn't a fire escape. Suppose you had asked, I mean, there's a trade-off involved. If the employer, if you believe at all that market forces work, then those people were being paid their marginal product. And so if there is a fire escape that's not going to be built, well, that means the workers would have to get paid a little bit less. And so right there, of course, the progressives wouldn't agree with me. They would say, no, it just would mean the employer would make less profit. But again, if you believe in their competition and things like that, competition would have pushed down the prices that that business would have earned, the returns to shareholders and so on would have been reduced and so on. More people would have gone into that sector if there were above average profits and that sort of thing. So ultimately, the workers show up and they're contributing a certain amount to the enterprise, and how, and so they can get compensated. And at the time, in practice, they were getting paid by getting a paycheck and not much else in terms of fringe benefits. So if they were allowed to take longer breaks, if there was like a bathroom installed, if the employer built a fire escape, if the employer put in ceiling fans because maybe it was really hot in there, they could do all that stuff, but then that would mean the workers would get less of a paycheck. And so the question is, if the government comes along and puts in building code, and then makes all the building, you know, them all put on the fire escape, would the workers have liked that in exchange for lower paychecks? And so I think to a first approximation, if you believe in market forces, you would say, well, they didn't choose that. They're, in other words, a competitor of that place could have offered a similar environment but had a fire escape and then advertised to potential workers, yeah, you're going to get paid one penny an hour less if you work with us, but if there's a fire, you're not going to die. And that didn't survive the market test. So it doesn't mean it was perfect. I mean, the workers might not have correctly calculated the probability of there being a fire that killed them. But the point is, it's not just this automatic, oh my gosh, how awful, of course the workers would be better off if there was a fire escape. Yeah, the workers who die in that one thing would have been better off if there had been a fire escape, but if you just impose a blanket rule, so in other words, looking at all the workers who didn't die in fires, they were a little bit richer because they didn't get money taking out of their paychecks. And it's not obvious, you know, they were really poor. They didn't have many skills, that's why they're working in such terrible jobs. So it's not obvious to say what the right thing to do is, and what happens with progressive legislation is that the government decides where on that those trade-offs are going to be. And, of course, in practice, it's a lot less efficient anyway. It's not like it optimally engages in those trade-offs. Okay, I kind of actually, that was part of my actual story. The other, so, let's say, besides sort of dry academic argument, which is what I just gave you, in other words, just saying for first principles is so-called progressive legislation, stuff about workplace safety, consumer purity regulations, things like that, is that the best vehicle? And also notice, too, it's not just an issue of should there be such rules or not. Question is also, if there should be such rules, does it make sense for the federal government to be the one implementing them? So, for example, upon reading the progressive era books, you know, the things put up by the muckrakers and so forth, like The Jungle and books in that genre, Americans could have been horrified, and maybe they would have learned things about business practices that they really didn't know beforehand, and maybe a lot of that stuff was true. Even if you had a pure market, you could say, well, what happened? And then you could have things like some factories, some meatpacking plants could come forth and say, hey, we're going to have an outside group come in and certify our processes. Like, they'll have inspectors that come in and give us a seal of approval. And so if you really care about this stuff, don't buy meat unless it has the seal of approval offered by such and such group. And they could do that. Sort of like, if you guys are familiar with UL, I think it's Underwriters Laboratories, and so a lot of electronics products, you'll see the little UL, and that means that this has been certified, so like, it's not going to electrocute you, and things like that, because it's been tested. Or even if, say, you don't know, there's got to be some kind of regulation, well, still, to be closer to a market solution, it could be that just, oh, if it's proven that you died because you ate a poisonous hamburger, well, then you can take the meat packer to court. And then given that liability now, they would have an incentive to go to an insurance company and say, we want you to insure our product. Because if somebody eats a hamburger, then they can take us to court and they can show that it was because it was impurities and the stuff we sold them. The guy dies, we got to give him $100,000. So we don't want to face that risk. We want to just pay you a premium, and then you, the insurance company, pay off any claims. Kind of like malpractice insurance for doctors. And then under that model, there would be inspectors, and there would be rules about, oh, anybody who comes in here has to wash his hands, or you know, that kind of stuff, or people working with the meat have to put hair nets on, and all that kind of stuff. But it wouldn't be that the government would be promulgating those rules. It would be the insurance company. They would say, if you want us to ensure your process and that we're going to be taking the financial hit if you kill people because you sell bad, you know, poisoned meat, then we're going to come up with procedures that you're going to have to follow. And to make sure you're obeying them, we're going to randomly send people to your plant and give you surprise inspections. And if we catch you violating this stuff, then we're going to fine you, or we're going to charge you higher premiums, or we'll just drop your coverage. Okay, so the point is, don't take from my previous comments that in a free market, it would just be no regulations or rules whatsoever. Or the same thing like with like somebody who, a building contractor. There could be all kinds of rules in place about, well, gee, if you want to get fire insurance, you have to have a sprinkler system, right? Just from the, cause from the insurance company's perspective, they're going to minimize the damage claims they have to pay if the properties they're insuring have adequate mechanisms in place to try to contain a fire. And they might also have arrangements with fire departments and stuff that are all purely private, because again, it's easier to put out a fire than let a whole building and all the neighboring buildings burn down and then pay to have all the buildings rebuilt. Or maybe it's not. The point is, let the market figure that out. Okay, so where I was going, though, is besides that, these dry academic arguments or these theoretical things where I'm trying to show how could a pure free market or something much closer to a free market solve these genuine problems better than having federal regulation come in. So besides that, there's also the fact that, that in practice, this legislation pushed by big business . All right, so the point is, when you go through and you look at the actual legislation, you know, the Pure Food and Drug Act, and you know, we're talking about tonight about the creation of the Federal Reserve, things like that, they're now hailed as these progressive accomplishments, and you go and look at their actual history and who was pushing them, who was funding the propaganda efforts or the educational outreach, depending on your perspective, it wasn't just this spontaneous collection of this grassroots movement of people who just wanted to have clean food or who wanted to have workplace safety. It was very often big businesses that stood to gain from the legislation. And at first that sounds paradoxical. Why would business be clamoring to get more regulations put on itself? And a lot of libertarians are very naive in that respect. And I used to think that myself when I was a teenager, first reading up on this stuff and learning the virtues of the free market and started to realize all the problems with government intervention. I thought for a while that every big business person must be a total radical libertarian, or at least on economic issues. But surely they would want the government to lift the shackles off of their own business. But of course that's naive, because the big businesses are better able to comply with inefficient government regulations that have high overhead costs of compliance. And so in our times, things like Sarbanes-Oxley, the accounting and financial reform legislation that went through after the Tyco scandal and Enron accounting scandals, there's all this new regulation from Washington that went through, and a lot of the bigger firms actually supported it, because what it ended up doing, it just meant you had to jump through all these hoops if you were at all engaged in the financial services sector. And you had to have an army of lawyers and accountants preparing all these extra documents to show the federal government that you were compliant now with these higher standards of regulation. And the point was, yeah, that made it more expensive to do business if you were a Citigroup or something, but you already had a team of lawyers and tax accountants and stuff on your payroll, and it was just a matter of maybe hiring a few more or whatever. But if you were a mid-range business or a small mom-and-pop operation, you couldn't possibly comply with that stuff, or it was a much bigger burden for you. And so the point is, big businesses actually saw the opportunity here to hijack these social concerns and these movements against particular injustices or outrages of the capitalist system, and they molded it to suit their interests. So don't misunderstand. I'm not saying here the progressive movement as a whole was just generated out of Rockefeller's mind, and that every single person who wrote in this genre or who marched on Washington or whatever was really in the pay of Rockefeller or Morgan or something, and that they were all part of this big scam. And that's not what I'm saying, but my point is, the movement was channeled, and if you look at these major milestone pieces of legislation and read up on the history of why they got passed and who was behind it, it's the story is never that, oh, there was just a spontaneous thing and there were no big business people involved. So it's ironic, because the progressive rank and file think they're fighting big business, and they think they're striking a blow against the plutocracy, when their whole movement had been co-opted and was being used by plutocrats to further enrich themselves and protect them from genuine competition. So in other words, once you got on top, well, hang on, I'll get to the next slide where I spell this out. Actually, that's going to come in a few slides. So I'm going to come back to this train of thought in a few slides. But right now, all right, this issue of the robber barons. So this was a term, so it was made famous by this book over here, The Robber Barons, and it was about the titans of industry, or the industrialists. So the people who were really big, basically from like 1850 to 1900 or so. And people like Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J.P. Morgan, and so forth, and Cornelius Vanderbilt. So people who, Charles Schwab, people who founded these major businesses who were often billionaires back, you know, around 1900, and at that time $1 billion was a lot of money, and the idea is that they just were these titans who took over. And, oh, man, the federal government was so weak and powerless at the time to stop these wolves from just ravishing all of the poor, helpless consumers, and they just all formed these big monopolies and everything, or these trusts. And thank goodness the progressive movement, among its other achievements, brought us antitrust legislation, imposed income taxes at the federal level, did all sorts of other things to just really clamp down on big business and put the people in charge of the country rather than having these rich capitalists in their top hats running the show. Okay, so that's the standard story. And to debunk that, the single best reference is this book by Burton Folsom. So he, as far as I know, he's still there. He was a history professor at Hillsdale College. And he so he was there when I was teaching, and I think also I think he wasn't there when I was a student, but he like we were using his book, and then I think he was hired at some point, and he and I overlapped there. Anyway, great guy, and this book is a slender little volume, and what he does is just go through the actual history of these people, and he makes this a distinction between the political entrepreneurs and sort of market entrepreneurs. Okay, so in this book, Folsom says, yeah, there were some robber barons, if you will, and the way they got their money was by running to the government, getting privileges and having people, the government guaranteeing them market share. And I said, but there was this other class of entrepreneurs who made their money by serving the consumer and bringing down prices. And so he just goes through and just has like a bunch of little mini biographies or biographical sketches of some of these household names like Rockefeller and Carnegie and J.P. Morgan and so on, and just shows how a lot of these guys made their money by doing what entrepreneurs are supposed to do, by delivering a better product, by driving down prices. And he's got some statistics in there like how the price of kerosene just collapsed once Standard Oil came on the scene and the various ways that these guys did things. So let me just read you a little excerpt. So here, this is from my book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, but I'm quoting here from Burt's book, Myth of the Robber Barons. So here he's talking about, just to give you one example, he's talking about Charles Schwab. Okay, so the financial firm Charles Schwab, this is the guy that founded that, and that's why it's called it. So he, of course, was very successful. So what sorts of things, why is it that these guys became rich? What did they do? And so this is Folsom giving a little anecdote about Charles Schwab. So what happened is here, the scene is that Charles Schwab, he's got all these steel mills that he owns. And one of them is just far and away the worst producer, right? So in terms of how much steel they produce every shift, it's awful. So he's going to go figure out what's going on with this place. So he's visiting this steel mill that's been part of his empire, and he's going to turn these people around. So this is now I'm quoting from Folsom. It was near the end of the day. In a few minutes, the night force would come on duty. I turned to a workman. So this is Charles Schwab telling the story. I turned to a workman who was standing beside one of the Red Mouth furnaces and asked him for a piece of chalk. How many heats has your shift made today? I queried. Six, he replied. So heat was like the unit of production that they used. I chalked a big six on the floor and then passed along without another word. When the night shift came in, they saw the six and they asked about it. The big boss was in here today, said the dayman. He asked how many heats we had made, and we told him six, so he chalked it down. The next morning, I passed through the same mill. I saw that the six had been rubbed out and a big seven written instead. The night shift had announced itself. That night, I went back. The seven had been erased, and a ten swaggered in its place. The day force recognized no superiors. Thus, a fine competition was started, and it went on until this mill, formerly the poorest producer, was turning out more than any other mill in the plant. All right, so I don't know if over the connection here that fully translated, but the point is there's a mill in his plant that was very poor, and he went up and he didn't yell at them, He didn't change, you know, their pay structure or anything like that. He didn't try firing people. All he did was say to the, you know, there were two shifts, a day shift and a night shift. And he just asked the day shift, how many do you produce? And he wrote it on the ground. And then the night shift came and, like, and, you know, they knew who he was. They knew that, oh my gosh, this is the guy who owns the whole thing. And then they just went back and forth trying to outdo each other, the two shifts. And before you know it, they're producing more than everybody, than all the other plants or all the other mills. Okay, so little things like that, and there's, I don't have time to read y'all them, but there's really great anecdotes like that about, for example, how Rockefeller, like some of his associates, were saying, yeah, you know, in our business, it helped to be able to see a little bit ahead of everyone else. And they said, yeah, John, referring to Rockefeller, he would see ahead of everyone else, and then he would see around the corner. Okay, so their point was, he could just anticipate where the industry was going to be, and then he would get there first. Okay, so it wasn't just a matter of, oh, being ruthless or something like that. Okay, so here's a little thought experiment, because what ended up happening is you've got all these rich people and that were taught, you know, that these titans of industry, these people forming dynasties, as it were. You know, Rockefeller, Carnegie, Schwab, and so forth, Vanderbilt. So here's a little experiment. Imagine you are one of the richest families in the country in, say, 1900, how would you use the government to help your grandson? I'll make it plural. Help your grandsons. Okay, so again, imagine you're these guys that through market means, you made a boatload of money when there was open laissez-faire, more or less, in the United States in the late 1800s. And so as of 1900, you're a bona fide billionaire, or maybe you've got $500 million, which is a ton of money back then. All right? And so your family is really prosperous or whatever, and you're looking about having your daughters marry the right people and this and that. You're plotting this whole you're looking at the future because you're getting up in the years. You are a success. You've made it. It's not like, yeah, you can try to make more money, but, I mean, you're kind of one of the richest people on planet Earth at this point, and so now you're more concerned about protecting it. So what do you do to ensure that the Schwabs or the Rockefellers and the Morgans aren't just powerful right now, you're at the helm, but they're powerful when your sons take over, and when your grandsons take over, what can you do? And imagine all these things. That with the central bank that's willing to give your, you know, because you own banks too, that's what these guys got into. The central bank is willing to bail you out whenever you get in trouble. That's certainly helpful, and that's not going to give money to the average mom and pop. Clearly, that's going to give an advantage to you guys. What about the income tax? What about the estate tax? Well, those things are clearly going to help you because those aren't wealth taxes. Well, the income tax isn't a wealth tax. And the estate tax also, if you structure your property right, you could put it in trusts and various types of things so that it's not getting hit. So what these things do is they make it so that somebody who's in the middle class right now and has a great successful business is never going to become a billionaire, or their sons aren't going to. It's just impossible. There's, you know, with the government taking whatever it is, 40% out of your income every year, and then when you go to hand the family business over to your son that comes and takes 50% right off the top, you're never going to get ahead that way, playing by the rules. Right, so that's a way to ensure that once you get on top, these things ensure dominance. And then even antitrust also, that might be the one where you would say, oh, come on, clearly antitrust legislation hurts biggest businesses, but no, not necessarily. I mean, there are, because it's used selectively, right? Right now, Google is huge. It hasn't been broken up through antitrust legislation. So what happened, it's kind of like having speed limits. Everybody speeds. And so the police, if they want to pull over anybody, can do it because the speed limit set it. You know, if it's at 70, everyone's going 75, but everybody's breaking the law, so the police. So the point isn't that it hurts all drivers. The point is it just gives the police a tool to pull over anybody they want to. And it's the same thing here where with this vague antitrust, they can just go in and break up anybody they want to. So the question is, if you control the government, right, if you know that, yeah, we've kind of, you know, we own the newspapers, we own the banks, we own this and that, we control the major political parties. Yeah, it's not guaranteed, but the point is if we have this antitrust hammer, chances are we're going to be able to influence who it gets used against, and it's not going to be us. And occasionally it will be us, like with Standard Oil getting broken up. And even there, though, it was another powerful family who was behind that stuff. Okay, so the point is I'm just trying to give you this perspective to think about. Another one, if you want to have a cute little conspiracy theory. I can't prove any of this stuff, but it's interesting enough coincidences. So the estate tax was introduced in the early 1900s, and at the same time, a bunch of these moguls established what were called 100-year trusts or dynastic trusts, meaning like a dynasty. And so it was they were putting all their assets into this vehicle, this trust. So it's not trust like a bunch of big businesses come together. It's a trust like right now, you know, you can set up a trust for your kid or something, like for how he can get money to go to college and stuff like that. And so it was sheltered from the estate tax. So in other words, like Rockefeller would put a bunch of his assets into this trust that would then be administered by Rockefeller Associates or whatever. But technically it wasn't in his personal estate. So when he died, it's not like the federal government got 50% of his net worth because he had moved it all of his assets into these trusts. And then but they were only like 100 years, just the legal structure of them. They weren't perpetual, so they expired. And what was the general time frame? You know, was there anything that happened about 100 years after these things were formed? There was a one-year window when the estate tax was zero, if you guys remember that. So I think it was 2010. I'm getting my – either 2010 or 2011, I think. But if you remember, like George W. Bush put in this thing about, you know, he lowered the estate tax, and then it actually was phased out. But then that expired under Obama. They let it all come back. And so just the way that the thing worked, the estate tax, the rate got reduced, and then there was a one-year window in which there was no estate tax. And then it went right back up to where it had been. So if you like to think like that, you know, you could have thought, well, gee, I wonder if those people took advantage of that to move all their assets out of these 100-year trusts. Can't prove any of that. Who knows? But the point is, I just want you to realize there is this perspective out there saying, instead of looking at the federal government, all these things as being these creations and these tools invented by the rabble, like the bunch of communist workers, to then use them to beat down the big businessmen. There's another school of thought that says, well, yeah, seeing those currents and what the political mindset was, a lot of these rich guys, many of whom had made their money legitimately in terms of libertarian principles, then sought to protect it by using the power of the government to knock out potential competitors. Okay, so let me give you the historical backdrop here. Again, this lecture tonight is by no means a substitute for the Rothbard reading. I'm just trying to give some highlights from it and to maybe throw in some flavor that you wouldn't have gotten from the reading. So, and also just in case certain things were puzzling you. So one thing that might puzzle you reading it is to hear Rothbard say that the Republicans were the interventionists, that they were for high tariffs, they were for paper money, and they were for, like, government debt, and that the Democrats were actually the party of sound money and low taxes and not a bunch of government boondoggle projects and low government debt. And that's kind of astonishing to people. But yet, if you go and look at the actual platforms and policies of, say, Lincoln versus Andrew Jackson, you will see that that's the case. Abraham Lincoln, the quintessential Republican, go look at his economic policies, and they're awful. Andrew Jackson, his economic policy, I mean, he did stuff like slaughtering Indians, things that libertarians don't like, obviously, but in terms of his economic policies, Andrew Jackson is unbelievable. So he got rid of the Second Bank of the United States, and he paid off the federal debt. So don't misunderstand. I'm not saying he balanced the budget. I am saying not only did he balance the budget, but he ran surpluses such that he retired the federal debt. So the U.S. federal government didn't owe anybody a penny at one point under Andrew Jackson's administration. All right, so that's incredible. And beyond that, if you go and read his speeches and so forth on these topics, you'll see his reasoning is good, too. It's not something that he had good policies and he got lucky because of his wacky ideas that for some reason spat out the answer that we happen to agree with. No, his motivation and the way he explained to the voters why he was for gold and not paper money and stuff like that, it was very compelling. And we talked about the dangers of a central bank. You can read those speeches today, and 99% of it is really awesome stuff. All right, so I'm stressing this because I remember I was in high school, I think. So I was already into the free market arena, and just with the shoddy teaching that we got, I thought Andrew Jackson was a fool. You know, I had been taught that he was against banking per se, and that, you know, he didn't trust commerce and big businesses and things, which it's not crazy to say, but it's very misleading, right? So it wasn't that he was against commerce or even banks per se. It was that he was against big Wall Street banks that were in bed with the government. And he was against the central bank because he knew it was liable to corruption and could pick winners and losers and funnel money to foreign interests and things like that, right? So I didn't have any of that knowledge. At the time, I was just more of, oh, well, I'm for free markets, and banks are part of the market, and banks are cool because they deal with money, and this president, for some reason, was against money. And that's obviously not at all what was going on. If you want, incidentally, my book that I co-authored with Carlo Lara called How Privatized Banking Really Works, there's a section in there where we talk about Andrew Jackson's campaign to get rid of the Second Bank of the United States, if you want to read more on that and see some of his quotes. And Danny Sanchez also has a great Mises.org article called something like, I think, Nicholas Biddle, the 19th century's Bernanke or something like that, because Jackson was going toe-to-toe with Nicholas Biddle, who was the head of the Second Bank of the United States. And there's some great quotes in there where Biddle is admitting that he has the power to throw the country into a depression. And he's, you know, in correspondence is telling people, like, oh, this president, this war hero, Jackson, thinks because he scalped a few Indians, he's going to get me to submit. Well, no, I won't. Wait till I bring the nation to its knees by restricting credit. I'm paraphrasing, but that was the spirit of what he said. And so the point is, just in terms of political economy, stuff like that is great when you try to show the average American, do you want to have this institution where if a guy like that happens to be in charge, he has the power to black, you know, to use the nation as blackmail, to say, well, give me my way or else I'm going to bring a recession or a depression on the whole country. There shouldn't be someone with that kind of power. But yet there is when we create this institution of the central bank. So people are asking where that is. is I think you can Google all that. Yes, yeah, so someone put in the thing about where my book is, and then Danny Sanchez's article. I think if you just Google it, maybe somebody can do it and find it. But it's Mises.org, and it's called something like Nicholas Biddle, the 19th Century Bernanke. Maybe it's just called the 19th Century Bernanke. I'm not sure. Okay. Let me give you a little bit. Also, remember, everyone, just to remind you, you can be posting questions in the Q&A box, and I'll answer them there, depending on how much time we have left. Okay, so the election of 1896 was gold versus silver was one of the big issues. So, again, I'm just supplementing Rothbard's lecture to give you some of the details. So this guy, William Jennings Bryan, he was the Democratic nominee, and he is the same William Jennings Bryan that you get heard of in other contexts. The Scopes trial and the was he the Secretary of State or the Secretary of War? He had a top level cabinet post under Woodrow Wilson, and he famously resigned because he thought Wilson was bringing the nation in unnecessarily into World War I. Okay, so a fascinating guy, and I think that element of it, say what you will about him, but I mean, that element I think shows his personal integrity. Okay, thanks. Somebody just posted the 19th Century Bernanke thing by Danny. So, interesting guy. He was famous in this context because he had what was called a Cross of Gold speech. So you may have heard reference to that. All right, so you know, using biblical metaphors and saying, you know, we, the nation's farmers, or will not be crucified upon this cross of gold. So, just very briefly, just to set the context. So there are various issues in the battles over the monetization of gold versus silver, and so the silver forces typically inflationists. Right? In other words, they thought the way to bring prosperity would be through inflation, and they thought having silver be the money would be the way to do that. That would facilitate more inflation. Why did they do it? Well, there are various reasons. It could have just been a simple view that, oh, depressions are caused because the people can't spend enough, and so you print more or create more money. There you go. But more specifically and more nuanced or more sophisticated would be if you were a populist and you identified with farmers. And so what would happen is they would tend to be indebted, so they would take there'd be a mortgage on the family farm, and they'd have to grow crops and sell them for a certain amount and pay the note off. And, of course, if they couldn't make their payments, and they go under, and then the bank comes and seizes their farm, and now the family's loses the family heritage and so forth. So if that's your concern, what do you do? How do you help that constituency? Well, general inflation would be the trick. That would tend to raise commodity prices. That would raise agricultural prices. And they've got fixed interest payments to the bank. So basically you would be a general inflation, by which I mean increasing the money supply, is going to help people who are debtors, but in particular people who are in the business of selling commodities. So that would be another, if you're trying to understand why were these people for inflation, that would be one major reason they thought it was helping the farmers and hurting the big bankers in Wall Street, so who cares about them? So McKinley is a Republican, and Rothbard goes through and explains how the Morgan interest, who traditionally supported the Democrats, were for the gold standard. They couldn't be Democrats this election because of the candidate openly embracing silver. So what were they going to do? And they realized there was an opportunity. They went over and convinced McKinley, okay, we'll deliver to you a lot of Democrat votes from people who are for sound money and realize inflation's not the way to go. But you got to be for the gold standard. And then that paved the way for the Act in 1900 that, you know, set up gold or U.S. dollars being linked to gold. From that, you know, that had to find the rules from that point forward until FDR comes in 1933. All right, so what I want you to take away from this, again, this might be confusing to you, just like nowadays people think that Republicans are free market, or at least in rhetoric, and Democrats are wishy-washy interventionists who are for inflation, and how we see historically that wasn't true. What's interesting here is that you may have thought reading Rothbard, going into read Rothbard, oh, Rothbard's going to be in favor of the gold forces, and he's going to be against the inflationists, because Rothbard's for, you know, gold being money, and, you know, there's problems with the gold standard, but at least that's a pretty safe check on government intervention and so forth on inflation. But that's actually not the way it reads, is it, if you've read it already. You can see Rothbard refers to the gold forces like they're the imperial stormtroopers or something throughout his narrative. And let me read to you in particular. He says, so this is Rothbard from The Origins of the Federal Reserve. But once gold was secured by the McKinley victory of 1896, they, meaning the Morgan forces, wanted to press on to use the gold standard as a hard money camouflage behind which they could change the system into one less nakedly inflationist than populism, but far more effectively controlled by the big banker elites. In the long run, a controlled Morgan Rockefeller gold standard was far more pernicious to the cause of genuine hard money than a candid free silver or greenback Bryanism. All right, so what Rothbard is saying there is, again, it's a nuanced position. He's saying don't be fooled by the rhetoric. Just because McKinley campaigned on sound money, hard money, gold standard, you know, money's got to mean something here, dollar is a dollar, and William Jennings Bryan's campaigning on inflation under a silver standard and having free coinage of silver and so on, don't think, therefore, that McKinley really was for sound money, that he wasn't, that the people who put him in power were not for what we would think of as true commodity money with no inflation. They were actually for this hybrid system where, yeah, the dollar was linked to gold, but they also wanted to put in place a central bank and so on so that they could get special privileges, and it was a controlled system. It really wasn't a pure free market with just this piece of paper that was printed by the U.S. government that they linked to gold, and that was the end of the story. Okay, what was the role of academics in all this? I'm going to try to hurry up to this remaining part, these remaining slides, leave time for your questions. So, again, the age-old question when it comes to this stuff, if you have these serious disagreements and you think that these people put in place this awful system, the question is, did they just do it, were they just intellectually mistaken, or were there nefarious motives? And Rothbard goes in and gives some of the background there. So I think it's a combination. What would happen is these banking interests who wanted to foster, to inculcate what looked to be a mass movement, they realized, you know, J.P. Morgan realized he couldn't just get up and start giving stump speeches saying we need to have a central bank in the United States, and I think it would be good. That by itself isn't going to help, because people are going to be suspicious for coming from J.P. Morgan. And so they needed to have an arm's length. They needed to have academics, college professors, people from prestige universities, people from other industries that wouldn't directly be affected by having a central bank come and give testimony, or, you know, major business people or something. to talk about. Wow, the up and down business cycles really hurt me. I wish we could have a central bank to even out the wild up and down, that kind of stuff. So it actually is more effective if you hire true believers, okay? Because they have more conviction and they have a long paper trail of, you know, having believed in this stuff and published on it even before they got hired. They get hired in some plush new position, whereas somebody who has a history of saying 19 different things on a given issue, depending on who's paying him at the moment, that guy's not very credible anyway. Okay, so there is that dynamic in place, and so when you read something like Rothbard's account, and some people recoil from that, and say, oh, come on, you're saying it was this big conspiracy? No, it wasn't a big conspiracy. He's showing the naming particular people and saying it was a conspiracy among them, and they would go out and hire people, and those academics were more or less pure. Because, again, it's not a dichotomy that if you're going to go hire someone to lead this thing, you would pick somebody who actually believes it, because there's a spectrum of opinion. And why wouldn't you go with somebody who actually believes it, because they're more passionate and so on? Okay, just because of time constraints, let me move on here. So the big issue was, so in terms of the academic argument, the big issue of why should we have a central bank was this notion of an elastic currency. And the idea was that, remember this distinction between liquidity versus solvency. And also related to this is the idea of a lender of last resort. So you want them to be lending to people who are not liquid, but who are solvent. All right, so let me just talk you through this stuff. So the issue is, what would happen during a financial panic, such as the one in 1907? Because the historical backdrop here, you'd have these panics. And that was incidentally part of the lexicon, that there would be these panics and or depression with a small d. And then it wasn't until later that we started talking about recessions. You know, they sort of like phase these things, because panic sounds really bad. And then I think during the 30s, people were pushing the word depression, because that actually sounds better than a panic. And then after that, you know, now we use recession, because that sounds nicer even than depression. And then I'm sure, you know, maybe after this one from now on, we won't even talk about recessions anymore. We'll talk about bumps in the road or something economically. Okay, but the issue is, what would happen in a free market, I say free market, in a pre-central bank panic, is there'd be some event, all of a sudden people would be concerned, they'd rush to the banks, pull their money out. And since, because of fractional reserve banking, the banks would start going under, and it would just set up a chain reaction. And at the same time, you know, the stock of money would actually shrink. And so looking at this situation, that just seemed like a crazy situation. And then what would happen is this issue I was talking about, liquidity versus solvency. So you'd have institutions, not just commercial banks per se, but even more general, other types of financial institutions, where they would be solvent, right? So their assets would be worth more than their liabilities, but they would be illiquid. And so the point is, they owed people money. They couldn't pay them right then. They didn't have the money, but they had a bunch of assets that, in theory, you know, had the market value of which was more than the money they owed to everybody, including the money owed that day. So the issue was, if they could just get a loan from somebody with their assets as collateral, everything would be fine. They could get the loan from somebody, pay off the people they owed the money to today, and then over time, you know, those assets would mature, they would get paid off on them, and then they pay off the loan. So that's, but you didn't have that. You didn't have a lender of last resort. What did you have to do? Well, you have to engage in a fire sale, right? So you'd have a bond that was going to mature and, you know, pay $1,000 next year, but you needed to sell it today because you owed somebody money today. And because you're doing this in the midst of a financial panic, everybody's scrambling to get ready cash. Everyone's trying to dump their bonds and their other assets and their stocks and whatever. And so what happens is, of course, that pushes down our price. So everybody's engaging in a fire sale, just hurting each other. So now everyone's assets get pushed down in price, and so you're forced to liquidate, and then you might go under because of that. So it was the, you know, it, but if it weren't for the crisis, you would have been fine. So there are a few major institutions that were not fine, they were insolvent, and they might have set the panic in motion. So I think it was like U.S. Bank went down in 1907, and that kind of freaked people out. But the point is, even firms that were otherwise healthy, it's not like they engaged in really speculative, crazy stuff, but they had maturity mismatch. And so once normal credit channels dried up and everybody else starts going down, and now they can't pay their creditors, so they had to start selling assets. Everyone's doing it. It's a chain reaction, then boom, boom, boom. So how do we solve that? Well, somebody like Robert would say, don't have fractional reserve banking. That would solve that problem. But the academics of the time, they say, well, what we need is an elastic currency. We need a currency system that can expand with the needs of trade, and when there's a crisis, that there can be this institution to act as a lender last resort. J.P. Morgan stepped in and did that in 1907, and people didn't like that. People were like, why should we be dependent on the whims of this one man, not realizing, well, if you're going to have a central bank, men are going to be in charge of that too. So it's kind of silly. But that was the thinking. We don't want to have our whole financial system dependent on the whims of this one guy choosing which people he's going to bail out or not. And again, this is very ironic now that we've seen what Bernanke does in action. Okay, Jekyll Island, I'm running low on time. Let me just, so this book, Creature from Jekyll Island, great story, as Gary North has said, just that title alone made this, I mean, you know, that was a brilliant title that Griffin came up with. Tells the story of, and I quote a little bit from this in the book I mentioned that I co-wrote with Carlos Lara, and of course Rothbard has some of these details too, but it's a great read in the beginning parts talking about the actual history of it. And it shows, I mean, these things come from things like diary entries from the participants, in case you're wondering, you know, how do we have these details? Because a lot of these guys wrote the stuff down, and then later on, when it was safe, they divulged it, or when they died, it came out. So they, again, they would do crazy stuff like the senators involved and the big bankers, and so these banking interests from around the world come, and then they would take a railroad car under assumed names, because they didn't want the press knowing that they were all meeting, because if the press knew they were all meeting, then that would spoil the fun. People would be suspicious. And they went and plotted this thing out, and the guys retreat on Jekyll Island that was the blueprint for what later became the Federal Reserve Act. Okay, last point here, and I'll turn to your questions. The very name Federal Reserve, and this is something that came out of you could read about in The Creature from Jekyll Island. They are arguing about what are we going to call this thing. And so the other is, let me say one thing about the Creature from Jekyll Island. So I've read it cover to cover. It gets into some interesting theories about big bankers being behind a lot of major world events, funding both sides of the world wars and stuff like that. So I don't know enough to say whether that stuff is legitimate or not. Okay, so what I'm telling you, it's a good book to read. I'm talking about the economics and the analysis of money and banking is really good. And then, in fact, I could tell the guy had read Rothbard just because of the way he dealt with certain things. And yeah, sure, lo and behold, you go and look in the notes, and he's read Rothbard and so forth. Okay, so I can vouch for the treatment of fractional reserve banking in terms of the accounting and the way it works economically. I don't know if the other, I'm not saying their stuff is wrong, I just don't know. So if you go in and read it, you know, you might see some surprising theories in there. And, but what I will say is that his understanding of money and banking is spot on. Okay, so one interesting story he tells is the very name, Federal Reserve, that they were consciously modeling the U.S. Central Bank on the other central banks of the major powers, like the Bank of England, the Bank of France, Deutsche Bank, and so on. So with the pattern of all those things, you would think they would call this one the Bank of the United States or something like that. But they didn't want to call it that because they knew Americans had this aversion to powerful centralized institutions. And so that's why they called it the Federal Reserve, because they thought that word federal would actually, you know, connotate distributed powers as opposed to calling it central. And then, of course, the idea of reserve to make it sound like there's something in reserve. So the joke that I've heard many Austrians give to an audience about the Federal Reserve System is they'll say it's neither federal and there's no reserve, nor is there a reserve. So that they did it for strategic reasons. They thought that name would be more palatable to the masses because they wanted to disguise what it was. So they were actively modeling it on the other countries' central banks. Okay, we got about 7 minutes left. Let me see what kind of questions you guys have here. Yeah, so Donald Bailey asks, what would I recommend to learn about the actual story behind the progressive movement? Yeah, he answers his own question. He goes, never mind, I'll start with Myths of the Robber Barons. There's also Rothbard has a very long essay on the progressive era. And so just Google Murray Rothbard progressive era history or something like that, and you'll find that. And so he goes through and talks about it deals a lot with World War I. And so, again, it's just interesting because you tend to think of progressives as being very anti-war and peaceful and, hey, can't we all just get along and let's not judge other people and people think differently from you, got to persuade. But in practice, they were at their heyday with World War I, which was extremely interventionist, obviously, from the U.S. perspective. And that's not a coincidence once you understand how the nature of progressivism, that it's, yeah, their goal might be to help certain people, but their methods are you use guys with guns to get your way because other people are too evil or stupid to do it the way you know is right. And if you settle the dispute, you don't try to convince them. You just go get this institution with a bunch of guns and you solve it that way. So it's actually not a coincidence, or it's not odd that the progressive era coincided with this huge expansion of the police and military state of the United States. Okay, Drew asks me, what president do you think is the worst all time, contrary to the popular belief that Harding was? Abraham Lincoln's pretty bad. So if I had to pick one, I'd pick him. Besides all the people that got killed, the fact that he read an address talking about the right of self-determination while he was slaughtering tens of thousands of people, you know, civilians, to prevent them from engaging in self-determination. Things like, you know, locking up Northern editorialists for opposing the war, and like I said, his economic views were also terrible from my perspective. Okay, Brad Skiles says, since inflation is the increase in the money supply and price inflation is the result, how do you explain the increase in the money from 1980 through 2007? This period seemed deflationary. We have since juiced the money supply. What about 1980 through 2007? I don't know what you mean, Brad, about this period seemed deflationary. I mean, prices are certainly higher now than they were in 1980, or in 2007 than they were in 1980. What is true for sure is that if you look at a chart of, like, M1 against CPI, they move in tandem from, let's say, 1947 to 1981, around there. And then in the 80s, M1 grows a lot faster than CPI does. And so that I will explain by saying the demand for U.S. dollars went up during the 80s. So if you just think that through, if the demand to hold money goes up, other things equal, the prices go down, or the purchasing power of money goes up. So what was happening, I think, is that the increase in demand to hold dollars was offsetting some of the increase in the supply during the 80s for reasons like cuts in the top marginal income tax rate and then the drop in price inflation, I think. So in other words, price inflation had been in the double digits there at the end of the Carter era and then came way down under Volcker. And so now you're more willing to hold dollars because price inflation is moderated. Okay, George Smith says, doesn't Rothbard consider any fractional reserve bank insolvent rather than illiquid because a fractional reserve bank cannot meet its liabilities as they become due? So George, you're right. Rothbard in several places says that fractional reserve banks are by definition insolvent. Maybe other places you might say bankrupt. But again, with the argument you're saying, they cannot meet its liabilities as they become due. I mean, just go Google solvency versus liquidity. What you just described means you're illiquid. That doesn't mean you're insolvent. To be insolvent means that your assets are less than your liabilities, that you owe more than you own. But just in general. Now, you could be solvent so that in general you have more assets than you owe to people, but if you happen to owe somebody money right now and you don't have the cash flow to pay them, because in other words, you could have assets that aren't money, and that's why the distinction comes in. So on that standard definition, I would say that they are solvent but illiquid. Now, I don't know. I don't remember Rothbard ever dealing with that distinction. So I don't know that I'm actually disagreeing with him. It's possible if I brought that up to him, he would say, oh, okay, sure. I'm just using insolvent in a colloquial sense. I don't mean it in that technical distinction where insolvent is one thing and illiquid is something else. I just mean they can't pay people they owe money to, so they would have to shut down their doors. Okay, Kay Warren says, can you say a few words about Operation Twist is an attempt to influence longer-term interest rates? Okay, yeah, so Operation Twist, we are going to discuss this later. Let me even write a note to myself to make sure I don't forget because I don't think, I don't have a pen handy. Yeah, I plan on later in the course, Kay, discussing that in detail and like going over the actual numbers and the dates of when they did it and so forth. But very briefly, the idea is it's supposed to be it's not supposed to affect the total monetary base, right? So it's not supposed to inject money in or out of the economy. It's just supposed to change the composition of the Fed's balance sheet. So what they're going to do is make sure I don't say this backwards. What they want to do is lower long-term interest rates. Because they're saying, geez, we pushed short rates down to zero, and despite all that help, the economy's still stuck. So clearly, what do we need to do? We need to do more. Let's push down long rates, too, because long rates right now are still positive. They're historically low levels, but they're still above zero. And so the thinking is, well, we all know that pushing down interest rates helps the economy, so why don't we do it some more? So they want to push down long rates. And the reason they call it a twist is that they're going to just switch the maturities on the Fed's balance sheet. So they're going to so pushing down long rates means they're going to buy long-term bonds. So that pushes up their price, pushes down the yield. That drives down long-term rates. So just think of it as if the Fed comes in the market and is willing to loan money to the government for 20 years for a lower interest rate than anybody else, it's going to push down the market interest rate. But then where do they get that money from? Are they going to just create it out of thin air and have more money in existence? No, they're going to reverse that injection of money by selling off their holdings of short-term bonds so that on net, the Fed doesn't own more bonds. It just sold off short-term ones and bought more long-term ones. So that's where the twist comes in. So in theory, it would raise short rates and lower long rates, but short rates actually in practice don't go up much because there's, you know, it's such a backlog. Okay. Let me do one more question and then I'll stop. And you guys have posted some more and I'll grab those in the Moodle framework. CB asks, what was the cause of business cycles before the Federal Reserve? I think Rothbard addressed this, but I don't remember his explanation. Oh, CB, you're killing me. Not only did Rothbard address it, but so did I. All right. So remember, the Austrian theory of the business cycle does not talk about central banks per se. All Austrian business cycle theory says is that you've got the market or the natural rate of interest that coordinates genuine savings and consumption decisions by consumers or households with investment plans by entrepreneurs, right? And then the commercial banks, if they create money out of thin air through fractional reserve banking and lower the market rate of interest below what that free market or 100% reserve rate would be, then that sets in motion the unsustainable boom. Incidentally, I kind of loaded the depth there. A free banker would disagree with what I just said. Right, so I'm giving you the Rothbard's interpretation of Mises. And it's up to dispute whether Mises, which camp he's with. But a solid case can be made that was 100% reserver. We can do that later if you want. Okay, so the point is, though, Mises, in the theory of money and credit, was not talking about central banks. He was talking about the banks, meaning the commercial banks, can create a business cycle if they inflate and lower the interest rate below where it's supposed to be. So what central banks do, though, is they make it – but remember, with commercial banks, there's checks on that. If you use a genuine free market. So even if fractions are banking legal, it wouldn't be wild up and down. Like it would be there would be market limits on that. And so the central bank comes in and batters down all those checks on what the commercial banks can do. So in practice, the central bank makes it much easier for the commercial banks to operate in unison as an engine of inflation, pushing interest rates way below where they would have otherwise been. So, yeah, you still have business cycles even before the Fed and other central banks. And then there, too, though, if you want to say, okay, so isn't that still showing business cycles in the free market? Well, no, you can go in and Rothbard does some places, talk about various government regulations in place that allowed those privileged banks to inflate, that protected them from customers punching them and putting them out of business with the bank run and so on. Okay, so it's just the central bank kind of systematized the distortions that government in general, the privileges government in general have been giving to commercial bankers. Okay, well, I got to stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Remember to do your quiz this week or next week, and I will, like I say, answer your remaining Q&A questions on the Moodle framework.